Honestly, unbalanced.
If your version of well-being requires constant effort, then it's probably not well-being. Amazing quote on the podcast by Rosie Underwood. She's a yoga teacher, journalist, and integrative health coach. And we explore why so many of us are celebrated for having habits that are actually burning us out. We talk authenticity versus aesthetics, nervous system health, intuition, social media, and how wellness can quietly turn into another performance. It's a grounded, honest conversation about reconnecting with your needs and finding balance that actually lasts. Now, a message for all yoga teachers listening. I feel you. Teaching yoga can be surprisingly lonely, even when you're surrounded by people most days. So I created a yoga retreat specifically for teachers from the 27th of February to the 1st of March. And it's not a retreat about networking. It's about being around teachers who speak the same language. Movement together, meals, silence together, and laughter. And just the kind of conversations you don't get between classes. It's a small group on a gorgeous estate called the Vedanta, and it's just one intentional weekend to learn, grow, connect, and restore. Holly Hustler will be coming with me to bring some sound magic. The location is incredible. There's a sauna, swimming pool, acres of stunning woodland and rivers. It will be a really magical weekend and a chance to rediscover your why. If you fancy joining, just head over to my website to find out more. And as a reminder, you can get some perks as listeners. You can get 10% off, frankly, the best yoga mats in the world, Lifeform, with code HUSTLER10, H-U-S-L-A-R-10. And if you're interested in exploring barefoot movement, then code HUSTLER20 is going to get you 20% off Viva Barefoot. That's all my kids have ever worn, pretty much, and that's pretty much what I wear every day as well. And remember, if you're interested in well-being products, Health, H-E-A-L-F, are the place to discover them. I've actually curated a really lovely list of my favorite products. If you head to thehustlers.com or honestlyunbalanced.com and check out the show notes, then you'll find eventually my list that gives you 10% off all the items plus my favorite products on there.
Yoga pants are not a real thing, are they? I just read your recent article. Yoga pants are not a real thing. And I'd love for you to speak to that, about why we try so hard to look good for other people. On Black Friday, it's a Black Friday especially, where we're recording this, where people are so tempted to get lots of stuff to impress people they don't even like.
Yeah, okay, so thought behind that was, I taught a class on a retreat and someone turned up who was well known to the public. And she just was in her pajamas, just full pajamas. And I didn't give her, what are you doing? I was like, I didn't really think anything of it. She was like, I couldn't find my kit. So I just thought, well, what's yoga? You've got to be comfortable, right? I'm most comfortable in my pajamas. And because she was someone that focused on her experience of the world instead of the world's experience of her. And as a result, everyone loved experiencing her, if that made sense. So
I
feel, and I used to be a journalist and a stylist. So for many years, that whole marketing dialogue was pretty much rammed down my throat. And it was like, it's sell, sell, sell all the time. And it didn't sit well with me. And it really doesn't sit well with me now in the well-being industry, where you're trying to make people feel good. And the rhetoric quite often is centered around, let's make you look good and then you're going to feel good. Whereas we need to flip it. I would caveat that with saying, yeah, you can make yourself feel good by looking good. It does work. Like, I used to be a stylist too. And you'd put someone in a certain outfit and it would make them carry themselves differently, but you put that same outfit on someone else and it wouldn't have the same effect. So it is, it all does, cliche as it sounds, come down to authenticity. And the only way you're going to get to know your authentic self is to drown out the noise a little bit and to feel comfortable. And if feeling comfortable is wearing your pajamas, then that's what's going to come out. That's what people, that's people's experience of you. And I think the reason I speak to yoga pants in that sense is that I get people self-conscious about coming to class because they don't want to wear leggings, or they don't want to. And then you see all this marketing that's like bum sculpting and leg sculpting yoga pants. And I think that creates a big polarity between what we're actually trying to do for people. It's making them feel good. And when you feel good, you know to take a breath more, and you know when you get that kind of blood flow to your brain and you get that coherence between the brain and the heart, you make better choices for yourself and you are more, essentially more attractive person to people. And I think the focus on the world's experience of you instead of your experience of the world has got to be flipped. And it starts with feeling good, right? Always.
Are yoga pants dead then? I think I saw an article that was actually the younger generation aren't wearing leggings anymore. Leggings are for old people.
Really? Well, I do love leggings. I do love leggings. But like, I don't put them on.
But we're not like 19 and 20 anymore. I think it's that age group that I think are moving away.
We're millennials, hey? We're millennials and we love our leggings.
In terms of looking good, like, I guess there's two layers of looking good though. There's a layer where you're looking good by wearing something. Okay, yeah. And that can make you feel good. Like, I've started recently, like, I love Viva Barefoot, but I don't ever feel cool on myself when I'm wearing them. No, you're just flat. And now I'm wearing like my borderline cowboy boots again. And, I do feel taller and nicer. And I feel a little bit better than myself, but I still love my Vivos. But then there's the other layer of looking good through hard work, potentially, like physically, like without your clothes off, like forget clothes, you're looking good. And I've noticed in the wellness industry, you know, for being in it, since I was 18, so pretty much like 25 years or something in the wellness industry.
A whole lifetime now. Yeah.
And people getting very, very attached to how they look, and they're centering their emotional state based on how they look. Like, I'm only happy when I look this way. And I had it myself for a while that if I went even on holiday, I'd have to think, oh, can I take training equipment with me? Is there going to be a gym in there? There was one point where I didn't go on holiday because there wasn't anywhere for me to lift weights. And so I didn't go. Yeah. This is a long time ago. And very much fixated on that. And this is, I think, a real problem for many people. If you tie your happiness and emotional state to how you look, things are only going to get worse at some point because you can't keep that up forever. You are going to, all of us are going to decline. Maybe decline is the wrong word, but you got what I mean in that context.
Yeah, we'll change, right? And the thing that I think is so important to, like that realization, like you said, like finding the gym and things like that. I think what you probably realized there was it suddenly you were like, oh, hang on, I'm not doing this to feel good anymore. I'm doing it for this like outward facing version of me. And I think it's not about letting yourself go and just being all right with that. I do think there's a lot to be said for presenting something or someone and the feeling that that gives you, right? And I know for me, when I was much younger, when I wore heels on a photo shoot, everyone took me more seriously just because I was like a few inches taller. And but maybe because I had more confidence as a result of being a few inches taller, right? And those things can be very real. But the point being, the more digitalization progresses, the more people are getting focused on this outward facing version of them to the point where it's very hard to get to know yourself. And if you think about what meditation is, meditation means to familiarize yourself. I worry that the younger generation are finding it harder to familiarize themselves with themselves because it's just so hard to get quiet. And the things that, you know, used to be, as you know, as we're a similar age, used to be something to look forward to, have become a norm. And that's very human. That's very like, we like something, we want more of it. But you know, for me, when I was younger, to watch a film was a treat. Now if you look at kids now, they can watch a film at any point in the day if they want, you know. And so I think it's that there's a lot to be said for patience, and there's a lot to be said for getting to know yourself in quietude. And I think the danger is misdiagnosing our own needs, which we all do from time to time, but it's about finding what it, getting to know yourself and then going from that place of clarity, I think that's where it
So what do you do, kind of on a personal level for yourself, not for your clients, but what do you do to try to get to know yourself a little bit better? Because you were running around in your previous career, you were running around the world, you blacked out in Ritz, you have overwork.
Yeah. You know the story.
I know all the stories. I've talked to you so much. I know all the stories. So what do you do now to try and get to know yourself?
All places to black out at the Ritz. And I would have to tell people that, it was in the Ritz. And it was an interesting moment because, if you don't slow down, your body will do it for you. And in the Western world, obviously, we're so fixated on speedy accomplishment and attainment. And it can be very, very easy just to fall into that trap because our culture completely applauds it. So now for me, it's funny you're asking me this today. Today, for whatever reason, I found myself on a real, in that fast kind of energy, because you know you can slip. And when I get into that, I find it very hard to get things done. And I half do things and then I stop and I start. And that's a sign to me that my heart and my brain aren't talking, right? So the thing, in answer to your question, which is a very good one, by the way, the thing I do to downregulate that works for me personally, and I've started teaching it a lot recently, is brain and heart coherence. I love spirituality. I love the well-being industry. It's just the most beautiful thing. And I love that it's thriving because it just says a lot about, the mentality of a lot of people, that we do want to thrive and survive, and vitality is our birthright. We shouldn't be blacking out in public places. I think that I like to back my spiritual relationship with science quite often because I'm a Capricorn. Apparently that's a
of
thing.
Of course, that means
nothing to me. So basically, when you think about your heart as an organ, it's trying to communicate with the brain all the time. And your body's talking to you all the time, but it doesn't scream. It whispers, as you know. It gives you a little nudge until you get very stressed out, and then it's going to scream at you, and it'll black you out, or it'll give you chronic fatigue, whatever it wants to do. So the way I know that my brain and my heart aren't talking is if I get a bit frantic. And I just very quickly, and I just wanted to make that point because I think people think when they get in a bit of a state of stress and anxiety, it has to be a very big thing to change that. But it can be something as small as taking 5 slow, deep breaths and putting a hand to the heart. And that's super important because Indigenous people all around the world have been doing this forever. And I know that we intuitively do this when we feel something, right? I think I did to you earlier when you were talking about your son, like off camera. I just was like, oh my God, like that's so sweet. And it's this very highly intelligent part of us that has this these connotations of love, but it's communicating with the brain. And because we're so conditioned to be in our heads, it's very hard for the heart to talk to the brain. When we get the brain and heart in coherence, everything becomes easier. I get a lot more clarity. I can speak to the room more when I teach instead of having to remember things. And I can make clear decisions that come from me as opposed to what I think I should be doing. I stop shoulding on myself, as I put it. So that's my number one, brain and heart coherence. And it changes, to be honest, but I have to be by the sea and in nature a lot. And I've been doing a lot of, have you ever tried Morning Pages?
Morning Pages?
Morning Pages is something I do with my clients that I coach a lot. It comes from Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. And what it is you get three or A4, the big ones, sheets of paper, and you write 3 pages the second you wake up.
A3 is really big. I'm
yeah, A3. It is, isn't it? A4. A4's the one. I haven't been in school for a long time. You basically free journal for 3 pages, and it's basically a bit like getting a broom to your mind and sweeping out all the clutter. And I think the science behind it, again, would be that you get that spike in cortisol when you wake up to get you up. And if you have a busy mind, that means that your mind, because it's designed to protect and predict, it's going to try and garner certainty wherever it can. And if that means worrying about everything under the sun, that's what it's going to do. So the morning pages just sweeps all that out. It's like getting a broom and going, right, let's
so what,
just...
What kind of stuff are you putting on those pages? Is it almost like, is it a to-do list? Is it emotional state? Is it plans for the day?
It can be anything. It can be the things you're worrying about, if they're clarity. Sometimes I obviously go to gratitude because that instantly regulates the cortisol production in your brain. So that's a good one to go to. But it's different all the time. And the whole point is that it's not structured, that you don't think about it. You don't think, right, I'm going to write my to-do list. It's just, right, just write anything. And if your brain can't give you anything, right, I can't think of anything. And usually what's amazing about it is at the end of the page, of the third page, you hit on something and you're like, oh, wow, didn't know that about myself. There's so many ways. There's like the human brain and this operating system we live on is quite complex. And I think life is quite revelatory, but it's also so distracting. And I think if we can do the things that help us reveal the things we need to know about ourselves on a more regular basis, life becomes easier because we know ourselves more. And then when you know yourself more, you're a bit like, okay, cool, that's for me and that isn't. And I get a lot of clarity from that personally. But I do find myself getting pulled away. Like, obviously, like everyone does, like, you just get distracted, don't you? And you're like, oh, no, I've done it again, you know? And you can get in a bit of a funk. Do you get
Is this a new thing you're doing, these morning pages?
Morning pages?
Yeah. Or has it been
a
while?
Well, it's not a new phenomena for me. I learned about it when I did my integrative health coach training. So that was about 5-6 years ago. But, and I definitely give it to clients. I diagnose them with needing it. But more recently, for me, for whatever reason, I've just found it to be really helpful. So I guess, yeah, I've dipped in and out. So it's kind of new.
Because you've done loads of trainings, haven't you? I think somewhere I read like 85
experts. 85? Was it 85? Yeah. No, I've been taught by 85 different people, I think. But yeah, trained a lot.
You can call that, yeah. So 85 educators. So I guess two layers to this question. As you learn from people, what's your filter process to whether, okay, that thing is cool, but not for me, or that thing's cool and I'm going to integrate it with my clients? And then a separate question to that then is, what do you think your clients come to you for? Because I guess you can go to a coach, and a coach can be quite a vague term. Like, what is it you think clients choose you for, and what do they want from you? So there's two layers. How would you choose what to integrate in your methods? What's your filter system? And then why do you think clients want you?
Great questions. Amazing. Adam, new legend. So first question, in answer to the first question, filter system. I used to not really have one. I used to meet these people that I would put on a pedestal and be like, tell me everything. Like, I'm so fascinated by you. But now I genuinely stick a question mark over everything I think. So, and I think everyone should do that, right? You've always got to question the validity of your own thoughts. I think I can easily get lost when people throw facts at me without backing them. I'm one of those people that ask people all the time, like, where do you get that from? Because if it was a Netflix documentary, where did they get it from?
Is it an Instagram reel?
Yeah. Was it just a random bumper sticker quote that gets thrown around? Which, by the way, there are so many of, and loads of them are conflicting, right? So, I think, to be honest, I think it's a feeling. It stems from a feeling. You know, when someone speaks to you and you're like, oh, wow, that really resonates. And I've had a few teachers. One, Dr. Libby Weaver, who she taught Hugh Jackman like how to regulate his stress. And her teachings on stress just got me. You know, when something like hits you like an arrow, just incredible. So that feeling I look for. I also had that with Deepak Chopra because he was one of the first people to teach me about brain and heart coherence, except I think he called it something else. So for me, that in answer to that question, it's a feeling that I get physically in my body. And I think now I think about it, it's probably heart and brain communicating that feeling. It's a feeling of tapping into the parasympathetic nervous system and my shoulders go down my back. And I'm like, that really resonates. Oh my God.
The feeling combined with them backing it up with data and evidence.
So,
We went to a viewing of a school the other day, and this head teacher was saying, you know, we got this thing in the Ofsted report, good. We didn't get outstanding, but you know, you should just follow your gut, like buying a house. Yeah. And I was like, yes, but I'd also get a surveyor before I bought the house.
Yeah, thank you.
Which is kind of what they did. And I thought that was what went through my head at the time is, yes, you go with your gut, but then you get an expert or you somehow validate it or there is data or science.
So interesting, because you know what? I was thinking about this the other day. You know, when people say, again, quite often a bumper sticker quote, like, go with your gut, go with your heart, go with that feeling. And I think it's very valuable to question what that means for you as like a bio-individual person that's never existed before. No one's been you before. No one's had your DNA before. No one's had your history. No one's had your upbringing. So I think what we do, and I know I've made this mistake so often, is look for validity and value and worth in the eyes of other people, right? Mm-hmm. And try and gain that from them. Like, what does this person think? Let me, like, you know, what do they approve? And I think the mistake we make as humans so often is to mistake intuition and it's not a gut feeling, it's your instincts, right? So I like to surf, and if I'm to follow my instincts when I'm surfing, I could get killed, right? Because say I got caught in a rip, my instincts would paddle against it, right? But actually what you're supposed to do is relax and let the rip take you, and then you go out to the left or the right and you can paddle back in easily. But my instincts in that situation would quite literally kill me. Another example of that is once I was on a shoot and I was ironing. This was obviously back when I was styling, and it was in this like bougie location house, and I dropped the iron and my instinct was to catch it. And obviously, luckily, I then went, okay, don't. But my instinct was to catch the burning hot iron because it was like, whoa, I dropped it, right? So your instincts can really land you in it. And quite often people get those mixed up with a gut feeling, and it's that, right. The other example of that is, sorry, I've got another one because I just find this fascinating. When people are dating, and I coach people through this quite often, when they're looking for someone and they say, my heart desires them, what they're often referring to is their unbridled ego, right? They're like, he's tall, he's handsome, he's this, he's that. It's that my heart desires him. I'm like, it's not your heart. It's not, you've got that. And that's why I think it is important to ground yourself in the practicalities of earth school. That's what I call it, like earth school. Like, that's what you did. Like, I would get, I had a feeling about my house, but I also got a surveyor in to check that, like, the feelings aligned with like the physicality and the grounding, right? That's essentially what you were doing there, wasn't it? Like grounding it in reality instead of getting lost in the headiness of it all, right?
I wonder there, is it that our instincts are bad or like not optimal? Or if we spent more time away from the excess external stimuli we all have, our instincts would be a little bit better. But the reality is, our instincts are numb because there's just so much going on and so much unnatural stuff going on. And we're not entirely in tune with our body and gut feeling. What even is gut feeling? I think that is a problem for most of us. I reckon if all of us lived in the woods alone for a year, we'd probably far better using our instincts to serve us. And our gut feeling would probably be more valid. But our sensory system is just so overloaded and we're so out of tune.
That's a really good point. Because we should be able to trust our instincts, but we're these primitive beings living in this really modern world, and our minds are ancient devices that are primed to protect us, not to keep us happy. And they're constantly trying to keep us alive, and our minds are trying to garner certainty in an inherently uncertain world. I learned this from Peter Crone. He's an amazing mind teacher and mind architect, calls himself. And I think that's what's so important. We've got to think about and really downregulate by asking ourselves what's true. Because I think the narrative we're sold when it comes to feeling good is that, like, you've got to be calm. You've got to have a calm nervous system. Everything's got to be calm. But in reality, we are like descendants of some very anxious. Our ancestors had to be hugely anxious for us to have been able to survive, because life was very hard, much harder than it is now, way back when. I always say we're like the chihuahuas of like the human breed, like, you know, like we used to be wolves and now we're like, okay, can I order a coffee? Like, like I'm stressed because my milk froth is not working. That was me this morning. So it's like, it's, I think it's hugely important to familiarize ourselves with our primitive wiring and know that that operating system is fundamental and hard, we're hardwired to survive, not to live our best lives on Instagram, right? Once we understand that about ourselves, I think that that's a pressure valve. Life gets a bit easier. And then maybe, yeah, I think our instincts would become a bit clearer. And I guess it's about just finding, I think, time for a bit of boredom, do you think? You know, because we're so overstimulated.
Well, no one's bored anymore. You know, can't you, even if you on the train, you know, the train, I think the guy I love, a philosopher, and he says, you know, trains were meant for thinking, but not anymore. Trains are meant now for working
or
for scrolling Instagram or watching TV. And even I'm guilty of that. You know, when I plan my week, like I put jobs in to do on the train. And it's so rare we get to be bored.
That is
probably the most urgent thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like my creative juices really flow on the track. I think it's something to do with the movement and the. But I write loads. Like I can write a lot when I'm in motion. But there's something about just looking out of a train window that's so fantastic. Amazing, isn't it? It's like
you mentioned relationships before.
Yes.
So the question, part of the question previous was about why people choose you. So one of the reasons is relationships. And I want to loop back to relationships in a minute.
Yeah.
But that other question of why do you think people come to you rather than other people? What are people looking for when they come to you for coaching? Not for yoga, but for, and I'm sure there's
coaching.
Overlap, but for coaching.
So, well, it's interesting you asked me that because obviously I market myself as an integrative health coach because that's what I am. I'm a health coach. But I've noticed a pattern in my clients that they usually come for me for mindset. And I think that's because when I teach at festivals or I guess who I am as a person is I'm very upbeat and I love to uplift people. I like my granny and it was like this, there's a lot of optimists in my family. I'm from a line of optimists and I am an optimist. And I think that's what people come to me for now, to try and get a better understanding of their mindset. So it's definitely more mindset coaching and knowing how to elevate their mood. But it's interesting because the first thing I say to them is to be a human is to suffer, right? Mm. Like we're not these weird smiling assassins walking around. Like you are going to suffer as a human, but it's about your relationship to it. I love that. It's definitely now, if you were to ask any of them, I imagine it's more about reframing the narrative and their relationship to stress and their relationship with themselves, which kind of moves away from what are you eating today, you know. But obviously that is a massive part of it because that feeds the mind and the brain.
So genetically an optimist, I guess. Okay. So
yeah, I think a bit of both.
Do you feel that that comes with pressure? Because, for instance, my default is look a bit miserable, maybe. Happy inside. Well, no, but you don't come to me thinking, oh, I'm going to get a great hug off him. He's going to motivate me.
Like,
maybe I'm more grounding. Okay, perhaps.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, because I've seen you come off, I saw you come off stage at the festival this summer and I stole a hug from you because it just felt very...
Well, maybe if you know me, or maybe you're like my wife. When the optimist and grounding person combine, it works. But the question kind of relating to that is, do you then feel there's pressure to maintain that? Like if people put you on like this pedestal of being an optimist and always being visually happy, have you ever been in situations where that's been hard to maintain?
Maybe being
on a retreat or alike, and how have you maintained that? Because of course, like I think when you want to retreat with someone, when you're a yoga teacher, you have to be real and authentic, but you have to be professional and hold space for people.
Yeah.
So how do you manage that? Do you let your realness kind of take over, or do you put on the performance so you meet who people are expecting? What's your approach?
It's funny you say that because I've had a couple of situations in the last couple of years where I've had to do one of like my biggest gigs, like speaking gigs, and like I've gone through a breakup or something like about a year ago that happened. And I remember I rang a friend who does a lot sort of in the public eye, and I said, well, I feel like a complete imposter. I have a huge imposter syndrome. People are coming to me for help and I'm really struggling at the moment. And she said, speak to that. Genuinely speak to it when you're there. And vulnerability is connection. And I think it was one of my best gigs. I wasn't in a low mood. I had my energy. I love people. I get my energy from other people. So the second I'm on stage or in a room full of people, I get energy. And I spoke to that. And I think there's the situation life throws at you, because life is going to throw whatever the hell it wants at you. And I think I spoke to your relationship with plan B, and I spoke to, I'm making friends with that. And I also spoke to the fact that there's, we experience hard things and then there's our relationship to it. So there's our life situation and then there's our relationship to it. And it actually made the job more easy. I got energy from it. And I think it helped them knowing that, you know, they could relate to me in some way. And
can I just clarify, when you say spoke to it, does that mean you kind of announced that there was something going on? Or was it more you just changed what you were speaking about to feel more that it captured?
No, I did. I said that I'm actually going through some stuff in my life at the moment. And it was funny, when I said that, it was like everyone sat up. They were like this, like, oh, that,
it's gonna
like,
get real.
I got them then.
It's yeah, gonna like, get real like, now.
Yeah, suddenly I had them.
They're waiting for a breakdown on stage.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, no, like, I'm just gonna go backstage. But weirdly, it just makes me feel alive. And I've actually had it where that energy and that camaraderie of humans, like, we all, like, no one gets to breeze through life and it be easy. Not one single person, whether you're an optimist or not. Life is going to give you the cards it gives you. And I think we're doing ourselves a total disservice to act as if we don't feel the same things everyone else does. We all feel the same things, but at different times and sometimes under very different circumstances. And if we are, as coaches, as teachers, as people in the wellbeing space, completely bypassing that reality, and then I think it's not fair on our students. And I think the only way out of these things is through and not around. So you've got to look right at them. And I guess that's what meditation is as well. It's like, and yoga, it's not about bypassing everything that's going on in the world. It's about squaring up to it, looking at it, and then it dissipates, right? So I guess on stage and in talks, I do think it's important not to make it too much about you, because it's not about you, it's about them. So you can relate and you can speak to it, but don't make the whole thing about that. And yeah, I think there's a lot to be said. Ultimately, vulnerability is connection, right? And I really feel like in this outward facing world, we have like outward facing senses because we're like hardwired for survival, and we're living in this digitalized world where we just get presented the best of everything. And it makes us so disconnected from each other. I have conversations with people where I'm like, I'm not connecting with you because you're not trying to connect with me. You're trying to impress me. And if I went on stage and tried to impress everyone there, they're not going to feel any kind of connection. And I think the illusion is that we are all separate, but we're not. Like, we're so integrated. The science behind that is there. Like, our energy moves 8 feet beyond our skin, and the heart field is 100 times stronger than the brain's, and it gets entangled with everyone around us. So when I say I went on stage and I said, I've had some stuff going on and this is how I'm handling it right now, and I'm so happy to be with all of you because it elevates me, instantly they're lifting, instantly they're connecting, because that vulnerability is hardwired connection with other humans. And we're tribal creatures, we're wired to connect. And I think connection is everything. Community connection, everything for me personally.
Do you think, like, I completely agree that vulnerability is so important. Do you think sometimes in the social media age that people are leveraging it too much?
Oh, 100%.
As in, like, the yeah. only, like, like the tears on social media, I've seen a few people who share a vulnerable story, sometimes including friends, family, relatives, and just keep recycling it like every few weeks, but a different version of the same thing. And it almost feels like there's more disconnection. And I compare it to AI in that with a lot of stuff now, you're just going to assume in the future that most things you see, most videos are probably AI. And you're probably going to be more reliant on like live watching live sport or going to festivals and live music. Because you just assume everything you're watching is going to be AI. And I've become like that to somebody on social media. Like I presume everything I'm seeing to some degree is a performance of some kind. And then that's made me kind of numb to it. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I love that you said that because I think it's actually way more important than people realise what you've just addressed. And I'd say this with like a journalism background, this is how I'd speak to that. Sharing a vulnerability on social media isn't being vulnerable, it's broadcasting. Those are two very different things. Mm. You're not being vulnerable, you're broadcasting. Vulnerability is sitting with a real human, possibly one-to-one, right? More so than like, you know, how I just described at a festival, but still I was in a room with, I felt pretty vulnerable because they're all looking at me, like live. Holding up your phone, that's broadcasting, right? Mm. Sitting with someone, sitting with a human, your heart rate sinking, your eyes connecting, and telling someone, I love you. Telling someone, I don't think I can do this job anymore. Telling someone, I'm struggling. I'm not coping very well at the moment. That is vulnerability. And that is what we're losing. Or even just on a smaller level, if you meet someone, like I just got back from the States and they are better at that. I will say it's like they sit down in a cafe. I'm like, how are you doing? They're like, I'm a little uncomfortable today. I'm like, wicked. Like in England, we're like, yeah, fine, great. Yeah, we're fine. there's a disconnect, right? And so vulnerability isn't, I believe, crying into your phone or putting something on social media. That does help. There's an element of like sharing discomforts on social media so that it's not a huge highlight reel. And I applaud people to do that to a degree. And I think that's good. But it isn't essentially by definition vulnerability. It is broadcasting. Mm. It's a form of broadcasting. And that's a very different thing to the connection of vulnerability. Does that?
I love what you said about that kind of eye contact there and like your heart sinking. Yeah. And that's what men find so hard. You know, there's so much data that suggests that men are only really good at being with each other when they're side to side. They really struggle with face-to-face stuff with other men. Like with a romantic partner, different. But with other men, like it's, you only really look at the man if you want to kill him. That's when you're going to go battle with
that's
them.
That's interesting.
And men find that really hard, but yet maybe that's what they need more of.
How do you deal with that then? Because I do know there's like, because I always think as a woman, if I meet up with a friend and go for a walk and a coffee, it is true that apparently when you walk, you get more out because you're not making...
Or drive, got like long cardio.
Or drive,
like how much have you spoken? I remember as a child, most of my opening up and like open chats were on camping trips, like school camping trips or RAF cadet camping trips.
Oh, I did that as well.
Yeah, I know. Okay, I know you
did. RAF cadets. Love it.
But like sleeping in a tent with three people just looking at the ceiling.
And then
you chat because you're going to see each other. It's dark. So what was your question? How do I cope with that?
Yeah.
Like, as in, I think men are quite bad in the, I can only speak for myself, but you know, I'll be with my friends and like my wife will say, oh, you know, how's Chris doing? What's going on in his life? Yeah, don't know. He's moved house, hasn't he? Where's he moved to? Don't know. Oh, he's got a baby. What's a kid called? Don't know.
I'm always like that. I'm like, well, what did you talk about then? I don't understand. Like,
just rip into each other.
Yeah, and I always ask those questions and then I've seen met with nothing. You're like,
in terms of like horrible guy humor, I saw a really good strategy when someone keeps sharing like vulnerable stuff, let's say, we'll stick with that word for now, just for the sake of it, on social media, is on their non-vulnerable stuff, like write things like, oh my God, you're so brave for sharing that. And it's just a photo of their face. And be like, oh my God, you're so brave for sharing that photo. Just to kind of wind them up a little bit.
That isn't brave. I'll give you brave, right? It's like that. It's funny, isn't it? What's your relationship with social media like now? Because we kind of spoke about that a bit before, didn't we?
You know what? Back in the day when I grew so much, it was, you know, I'd do 12 photo shoots a year, sit on the toilet. I'm quite good with words. Write something nice to go under a photo and get like 5,000 likes. Mm. Whereas now, like, you have to really curate it. For me, I still kind of enjoy it, but it's just finding what works. And you know, there's a few times I've tried strategies that haven't really felt like me, and they haven't almost put like a voice on. They haven't really worked. I'm still playing with it because obviously now you need to do so more. And I've never been someone that likes taking photos and videos out and about while I'm in the moment. So even back in the day, you know, when I was young and single, if I went to festivals, I wouldn't take photos of myself at the festival doing yoga. I'd be in the festival and then forget and just kind of hope that someone tagged me in something that I could then reshare. So now there's an increasing amount of people like sharing stories, like beautifully done stories of their whole day and their experience. And you know, they'll go on a cycle and there'll be like 40 different shots. And I can't do that.
No.
I cannot do that. Mm. So I'm still working it out for me. I like words a lot. So I'm not struggling is the wrong word, but also just time. I have no time.
Yeah,
I've got all the gear, but just no time.
Yeah, I miss the days of one photo and a really beautiful long caption. And I feel like now it's becoming like that. I'm quoting someone else here, but I can't remember who, but it's like the party drug that everyone's addicted to, but no one can get high off anymore. It's like that, you know. And I used to love looking at a beautiful photo and reading a lovely, long, insightful caption. Now it's so busy and so noisy and like, I open it and I'm like,
You have your Substack, don't you?
Yes.
Which I guess is your outlet. So how does that do? So when did you decide, because obviously your skills are in writing.
Yeah.
When did you decide to have that more personal wellness writing, not sold to, and I'm sure you still write occasionally for other people, but when did you decide that actually I want to write for me, no publisher, and what was the aim with that?
Well, initially it was, I was just writing a newsletter to my clients, and then I realised that I found it so cathartic, and my background in writing has always been for other people, and when you write for a magazine or a website, they have a voice, and the whole you've got to fit your voice into their voice. And there's different publications that, you know, some people I'd write for, like the monthlies, for example, are a bit more open to that. They're like, yeah, we love your voice. We love hearing you as you write. But mostly you've got to fit a mold, right? And then I really found that when I was writing my newsletter, I would just start by just writing, this is my class schedule. These are, click here for coaching or whatever. And then I started writing what I was feeling, and it was just coming out of me. And it was just like, I had this happen the other day and it made me think X, Y, and Z. And people were emailing me back, like, thank you so much. It really helped me today. I really needed to hear that. And I was like, oh, okay. And I think when you write for yourself, but for other people, it's cathartic because you really meet yourself. Mm. And then if you can share that and help people, it's not vulnerable, like I said, because it's not really a form of connection because you're writing, you're behind the screen. But I really like to be brave of it and to, it's sharing pieces of me that I didn't know I needed to share, or even it's revelatory. When I write, I reveal parts of me. I'm like, oh, didn't know I thought that. Like the article I wrote the other day about yoga pants, I was like, I had no idea I felt like that until I sat down and started writing and it just came out of me. Maybe it's a subconscious thing, I don't know, but it's definitely very cathartic for me.
And on a practical level, does it convert to clients or people coming to your class? I know that's not the main reason for doing it, you're saying it's cathartic, but in the struggles of social media as perhaps a conversion tool, do you find that as another useful one?
Yes, I do actually, because when it comes to Substack or a newsletter, when it comes to business, with Instagram and social media handles, you're essentially building a house on rented ground, because at any point they can change the algorithm, they could just delete the whole app if they wanted to. But when you have actual humans that have signed up to receive emails from you or want to know where you're at, or which is what Substack is more like, it's more of a connection. It's more of a, this is for you. This is, you know, it's like when you, I have a funny relationship with Instagram stories, because when I stop using it, I notice I send pictures of things to the people I care about. Like, oh, look what I saw today. I want you to see it, you know? And then they're like, oh, that's really nice that she actually thought of me and sent that directly to me. Whereas it's on social media, it's more of a broadcast. Like, look at all of you that I know, here's this, you know?
And it's there's kind of, something, it's false connection, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, there's something impersonal about that. And I think with Substack, it's more friendly. It's a bit more of a giant hug. And I think people feel more connected on there. However, it's interesting because people will pour their whole hearts into these beautiful articles and they get like 3 likes, maybe like some of the best writers out there get like 20 likes or something like that. Whereas on social media, someone will put a picture of their coffee and they'll get like millions of likes. And I think what it's like, there's an air of acceptance on Substack that it's like, that's okay. That's the world that we live in. But we want to keep art and poetry and our thoughts alive. And I think some of the best writers and thought leaders I know are pouring their hearts out on Substack. And I really love where that is leading. Like, I don't know why.
Yeah, I love the idea of it. I do write in my newsletter. I could try and make my newsletter not to buy this, buy that.
Yeah.
It's amusing of things that I've read or inspired me. With a little bit of like, and also I've got this retreat, etc. Because I can't do the, like every marketing course I've ever done, it's like, you need to send these emails in this order. And it just gives, I'm not saying it's bad to do that, but it just gives me the ick, that kind of pushy sales, that do, leading with fear. Like, you need to do this. And I'm like, I can't do it. And I know I'd make a lot more money if I did, but.
Yeah, I'm the same. But also, what I like about you is that, like, in psychology, they have this thing called, like, unique pairings. It's like, no one's all one thing. And I think quite often people market themselves as one thing because they think, right, I've got to be this thing. And I've always been quite multi-passionate, as I know you have. And I think the unique pairing that you have is that you're like, this is what's serious about yoga, right? This is actually really important, right? Let's all talk about this thing that's really important, because I've heard a lot of this and I need to call this because it's actually on my mind and I need to speak to it. But then you'll caveat that with the unique pairing. So you've got this like serious male yoga teacher who's strong and very good at what he does. And then you'll be like, isn't it hilarious when the yoga teacher tells you that they're playing the flute in the Himalayas and you just need cover? And suddenly you're like laughing. So that unique pair is really attractive. And I think that's what draws people to you and your classes and everything you teach. And that's something that's so simple. And I think we're taught, in order to get revenue or people, we've got to be like really good at marketing and sales, all this stuff. But actually, you just need to be an attractive person. Like, as in, not like we were talking about earlier, not like, oh, we need to look great, but your energy and everything you are and everything that you do is attractive to people. You're funny and you're quite smart at what you do. Great. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what? I think that's where, like, my wife does well. Like, she's useless at social media, doesn't really care.
Yeah, see, but there you go.
People like her and adore her. Yeah, that's
probably because she's not so much in her head, though, as well. Do you not think?
And it's harder, isn't it, with social media, because you see the numbers all the time. It's very stressful. And you see other people's numbers. And then you see how many people watch your story. And you see all those people that like see everything but never interact with you at all. And then you get this like anxiety and you're like, well, why aren't you doing that? Oh, anyway, let's do quick fire. Success. Yes. What is that for you right now? What does success look like?
Success. Oh, that's a good one. Do you know what? It's a feeling of peace. And I don't use that word lightly because I think it's thrown around a lot. But I think it used to be the kind of speedy accomplishment and attainment. And now it is actually just getting so much joy and peace from the simple pleasures, like taking the dog down to the beach and just running freely on the beach. I love just making my morning coffee and just standing outside and just breathing in the air. It's like, it sounds so cliche. I used to hear people talk about those things and be like, what's that about? And being able to connect with people and have a sense of community. Like, community is so important to me. I feel like I have a really strong one. And that there were points in my life where I was like flying around the world doing X, Y, and Z, getting huge pats on the back. And I would come home and be like, where's the village? Where's the community? Is it, there's no one here, you know? And I really want to strive for community and peace within that. And laughter. That's success, isn't it? Like, having fun. Like, giving less fucks. Don't know if I would swear on it.
Connecting to the inner, sorry, you're right. The inner child stuff. Next question. When was the last time, what were you doing when you last felt content?
Oh, I love contentment. what was I doing? I was, sorry, I've got jet lag brain, so it's quite hard to drop into it. I was actually swimming in the sea back here in Wittering with someone that's very close to me and a dog that I adore called Billy. And I was happy as a clam. And it was like cold, sunny day and no one was in the sea and the waves were pouring in and it was just, you know, when you just go like, woo, like, and it just felt like that is, I think being in the elements like that is just, it's just really lovely. And then also morning coffee is just the content time, isn't it?
You need to get to Wittering. I've heard so many things about Wittering. Is it west or
west
east?
Wittering.
Is west one the nice one? Is west nice
yeah,
than east?
You want to go west.
West,
I mean,
is nice
east
one.
Is pretty cool, but like, yeah, east or west.
What are you, whose teachings or what kind of teachings you are new to you, are you exploring at the moment?
Oh,
it could be books or stuff you're watching or just taking in.
Peter Crone. I actually went to see him live the other day. He was in England and one of the guys that works for him called Gary Waters is an amazing guy. So both of those, me and my friend Jasmine Hemsley, you know, Hemsley
yeah.
sisters, we went to go and watch him and I don't know, to see someone who like work with people's minds and see the transformation that they have in such a short space of time live, really amazing. And then always, I always go back to Deepak Chopra's teaching, especially because of his brain and heart coherence work. I'm writing a book about brain and heart coherence, so that is really exciting. So I'm constantly learning about that. And who else?
That'll do.
There's so many.
That's good.
That'll do.
And where can people find you? That's a laughing thing. Where can people find you? What you got going on?
RosieUnderwood.com is my website. Instagram, Rosie J Underwood. And I don't know what my Substack even is, which is bad because I've just been banging on about it. But just my net, it's always my name. That's
see, yeah, see, it'll be easy to find, won't it?
Yeah, Rosie Underwood. It's called Call to Confidence.
Call to Confidence.
So that's like that. You can find me there. And I've got retreats coming up. And it's funny this time of year, isn't it? That like retreats are there, but it's like, I love it when it's like the beginning of the summer and it's like, come and see me at festivals because it's really more open, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't do as many retreats now. I find retreats, I do love retreats.
Yeah.
But just the process of organising them and stuff, I'm just, I can't.
Yeah. Also, do you find as well, do you remember didn't we do a virtual festival once in lockdown?
Did we?
We did. Yeah, we did. It was with Bamboo Clothing.
I vaguely remember, yeah.
And we had, it was like definitely with Bamboo. It was like, but obviously it didn't feel like a festival because we were on Zoom and they were like, and Adam, go. And then it was like, and Rosie, go. And we were like, but we're on Zoom.
And there was a mountain festival. Or was it a mountain
festival?
Yeah,
that one.
Yeah, sponsored by Bamboo. Was it the Kendall Festival?
Yeah, that one. That was it.
Which is this weekend, actually.
Is it? Are you doing it?
No.
I'm not
some of my acquaintances are up there. Well, in fact, I'm going to Lake District this weekend for a retreat, but not the Kendall. That's where it is, isn't it? It's Kendall
Lake District.
Yeah, that's where it is. I've never been. Maybe I'll go one day.
Yeah, no, it'd be nice. Go. It'd be nice. Go and see it in real life, not on Zoom.
That was really weird. I got invited to that and never invited actually in life. Maybe I didn't make an impression. Cool. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That's a really, really lovely
chat.
Thank you.
It was so
nice
lovely. It was so nice to see you. And I think all your work is amazing and keep doing what you're doing. Honestly, unbalanced.